You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast.
So you can actually go into a world where you interact with the artificial intelligence.
What are the responsibilities when you create a new technology?
It's a moral dilemma with themes of playing God and the future of artificial intelligence.
If you make something ever more lifelike and they're sufficiently able to mimic human emotion, at what point does it become alive?
You have forces colliding here that have far-reaching implications. What we're tackling is what really makes us human, and at the end of the day, who will have more humanity, the robots or human beings?
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a preview clip of the new TV series Westworld, which premiered on HBO this past weekend. The reboot of the 1973 Michael Crichton sci-fi thriller centers on a futuristic theme park inhabited by robots who fulfill customers' wildest dreams. But it all goes horribly wrong when those robots, quite literally, start to have a mind of their own. These days, artificial intelligence seems to be everywhere, not just on television shows, but in movies and the news, where every day you can read articles about rapid advances in cognitive technology and ominous op-eds predicting that AI could be a massive job killer, or worse, a massive people killer. It's come up a number of times on previous episodes of this podcast, including my talk with futurist Professor Michio Kaku. Here's what he had to say about AI.
We can now create robots that can beat any human in any of the classical games. However, you cannot go to DeepMind, slap it on its back, and say, congratulations, you just won this tremendously historic debate. In fact, the computer has no self-awareness. It doesn't even know that it's a machine. It doesn't know that it won a game. It doesn't even know what a game is. It's an adding machine, a very sophisticated adding machine that can actually learn a little bit, but we forget the fact it's a one-trick pony. It can add. Now, that doesn't mean that in the future, we might not have robots as smart as us. I'm just saying that we are many, many decades away from that. Our most advanced robot is called Asimo, built in Japan by the Honda Corporation. But I interviewed the inventor of Asimo, and I asked him, how smart is the world's smartest robot? And he was very honest. He said that his creation, the smartest robot on Earth, has the intelligence of an insect. The Terminator robot that takes over the world and sets off a nuclear war, that is real science fiction for the next century.
Some call it a Pandora's box and warn that it may be man's final invention, the one that will surpass us and then destroy us. But then there's also the potential for AI to greatly ease our burden, taking over the jobs that humans can't do because they're simply too dangerous, as well as the jobs that humans don't want to do. Think about it. What if a computer could handle most of the tedious, time-wasting tasks that suck up so much of our day, freeing us up to spend more time focused on the things and the people that matter most to us, or endeavors for which humans are uniquely suited and yield the greatest rewards, such as creative work, science and exploration, invention and innovation. In this two-part series, I'll examine the many sides of this complex issue that's forcing us to think about the really big questions about where cognitive technology could take us for better or worse, how do we control technology that can think for itself, and if we create something that achieves human-level consciousness, do we have a moral obligation to then confer on it human rights? But first today, we're going to focus on AI in the present and near term. I'll talk with the man in charge of the Watson Project at IBM, who'll discuss how cognitive computing works and how it's already increasing productivity in a variety of different industries. I'll also talk with a software developer who authored a best-selling book cautioning that the introduction of AI into the human workforce could lead to outright economic collapse and widespread unemployment. And I'll talk with the co-founder of Wired Magazine, who says the next three decades or less will be a new industrial revolution in which every household item that became electrified in the first industrial revolution will become intelligent and radically transform society for the better. Coming up in just a moment.
Paganini's 24 Capricci set the standard for etudes for this instrument. Watson.
What is violin?
Good.
2000, same category.
From 1911 to 1917, this romantic Russian composed etudes tableaux for piano. Watson.
Who is Rachmaninoff?
Rachmaninoff is correct, and that adds to your lead. You're at 13,400. Go again.
Cambridge. I'll wager $6,435.
I won't ask. I won't ask. Here's the clue for you, Watson. The chapels at Pembroke and Emmanuel Colleges were designed by this architect.
Who is Sir Christopher Wren?
You are right, and that adds to your total.
You might remember that 2011 Jeopardy tournament in which the reigning human champion, Ken Jennings, was soundly defeated by an IBM computer named Watson. Well, Watson's come a long way in the past 5 years, and so the first person I wanted to talk to about AI is Dr. Gururdith Banavar. Dr. Banavar, or Guru to his friends, is Vice President and Chief Science Technology Officer for Cognitive Computing at IBM, where he leads a worldwide team responsible for creating the next generation of cognitive systems known as Watson. He brought me up to speed on the progress Watson has made and how software that does the thinking for you is transforming lives and businesses right now. Guru, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
So first, tell us about Watson. What exactly is Watson? What does he do? We've seen him from the game show. And is he a he or a she, technically?
It's a family, I would say.
Okay. Yes. I'm calling him a he. But
yeah. So, you know, Watson is a family of machines, so to speak, which can help professionals do a lot of things that help them with decision making, with discovery, and with very deep domains that people, you know, work in, like healthcare, like financial services. So when you think about AI, you think about sort of these general purpose agents. But when you think about Watson, think about machines that can help professionals do their job.
What type of professions would Watson and AI be able to assist?
So let me go back to the game show, the Jeopardy show that Watson played on. So that was a question answering kind of a show, as you remember. So as soon as Watson won that show, the first few calls we got were from healthcare professionals who said, listen, you know, we always have lots of questions in the context of a patient, in the context of the research that they're doing. And what if, you know, Watson could answer some of those questions by going through massive amounts of data, massive amounts of reports and scientific literature, clinical trials and what have you. And so that became the first area that we applied Watson to. And today we already have an entire business called Watson Health that is focused on applying Watson for for supporting practitioners of different kinds, whether they are clinical trial specialists or physicians or oncologists or radiologists, the entire spectrum of professions that's in the healthcare industry.
Down the line, what do you see as some of the other applications that you might be able to use AI in?
Yeah. So, you know, we call Watson as the first instance of a broader category called cognitive computing. And cognitive computing is this partnership between people and machines to do what professionals do in pretty much every industry. So you can look at, you know, financial services industry as an example. And there are financial advisors who usually have to read a lot of materials, ingest a lot of data before they can give advice to their clients. Watson could potentially help them with, you know, first of all, ingesting all of the reports and articles and the financial data that's out there, but also understanding risk appetites for specific individuals and providing a few options that the financial advisor can then propose. But it's not just financial advice. It's also on the compliance side. You know, financial institutions have to do a lot of compliance-oriented activities. They also have to do a lot of fraud and abuse-oriented activities. So Watson could help financial institutions do all of those things. And I could pick, you know, other industries. I could pick education. I could pick, you know, manufacturing. I could pick any industry. And if it's oriented towards data, okay, then Watson can help you.
So it could just about apply to anything.
Yep.
Except
yep.
for the oldest profession in the world.
Well,
probably not that. But
yeah.
You said that it was a partnership between businesses and AI or cognitive computing.
Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of other people who their fear is that it will be a replacement for people in various businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a valid concern?
Well, look, the way I think about cognitive computing and all of these AI type of machines is that any business or any profession consists of a number of tasks. And some of those tasks are going to be very much more appropriate for machines. And other tasks will be really good for people. People are good at certain things like, you know, self-directed goals and, you know, common sense and value judgments and so forth. Whereas machines are good at doing large-scale data processing, statistical reasoning, and those kinds of things. So you have to look at each task and you have to say, when can I apply a machine and when do we need a human? So when you think about a combination of human machine, then I believe that you know, every job can actually be more effective if you employ computers at the right place in the job.
Okay. And how does artificial intelligence work? Is it just a matter of you program it with an infinite number of scenarios and answers, or is it actually thinking for itself?
So, you know, fundamentally, many of these machines are learning from data. So they are fed examples of different scenarios and they learn from that data and they create, internally, they create a set of, you know, models or rules about how to operate with when different kinds of data are presented. And there's also cases where there's got to be some reasoning algorithms that have to be plugged in for making decisions, for example. You know, if you look at certain kinds of data, mm-hmm. there's certain kinds of decision options that become available and so forth. So it's a combination of learning, reasoning, and ultimately it's about interacting with people using things like natural language and speech, gestures, and so forth. So it's a combination of these learning, reasoning, and interaction.
Can Watson or some type of artificial intelligence computer basically have access to the data through the internet and start operating on its own based on those algorithms?
Well, as I said before, it depends on what is the question you ask the computer,
right,
or what is the task you give the computer, right?
Yeah.
So you can give a task. For example, you could say, find me all the articles relevant to immigration. And, you know, Watson could go off and find many articles from Wikipedia, from New York Times, from Economist, from everywhere, and digest it for you and give you a kind of a summary of research on the topic of immigration and, let's say, economy or something like that. But that's not to say that, you know, Watson has gone off and done something on its own. You asked Watson to do something
right
for you, and so Watson comes back, and then you can use that information for whatever you like.
What's the difference between what you're talking about and, let's say, Watson being able to do research on immigration through the internet and make a recommendation on immigration policy, for instance?
Look, I mean, if some policymaker wanted to get what the data was on the impact of immigration on the economy, I think Watson would be a great tool to do that research. But at the end of the day, the policymaker has to make the final decision, looking at all of the options that were provided by Watson, right? So what I think of Watson is a decision support system. It's not a decision maker, but it's a decision support system. And the person who is working with Watson has to make the decision at the end of the day.
In terms of the amount of power and information between Siri on my iPhone right now and Watson, what are we talking about?
Well, look, Siri can do some very simple day-to-day tasks. What we're talking about with Watson is doing professional level tasks. And that means, you know, doing things like radiology or doing things like, you know, research on immigration or doing things like financial services advice and so forth. That requires a huge amount of data, which you obviously cannot fit on a phone. It has to be out in the cloud. And there's a lot of reasoning algorithms that also have to be out in the cloud to get access to all of that information and then summarize it. But of course, you know, all of that ultimately can be accessible through your phone. You can have an application which connects to the cloud and leverages Watson.
Oh, interesting. So I would be able to access Watson through my phone or any device.
Exactly.
And is there's a physical computer, I assume, then at somewhere. How big is the actual computer?
Well, Watson,
or does
it
depend?
Well, you know, Watson is now in the cloud.
The purpose?
Now in the cloud.
Okay.
So it's actually distributed in and it's available in any part of the world pretty much.
Okay.
You know, we have projects going on in Asia, in Australia, in South America, you know, in Europe, of course, in North America, all of these places. So Watson is in fact a set of services that's available in the cloud. It started off by being, you know, 5 years ago when we did the Jeopardy match, it started off by being a very large, you know, supercomputer, which was consuming 85,000 watts. Right, of energy and so forth. But now it's been broken into smaller components that can be recombined for different applications and accessed from anywhere on the planet.
How far are we with AI from, in theory, AI achieving the singularity, which is basically self-awareness?
Yeah. Well, you know, my opinion is that the practical applications of
AI.
Let
me back up.
Okay.
Let me ask you, how would you define the singularity?
I think singularity is a point at which machines become better than humans in terms of their general intelligence. As in, you know, they are able to do anything better than any human.
Okay.
Okay, that's the point at which it's called singularity.
Okay.
Right? But, you know, my view is that if you look at all of the professions we work on, you know, the amount of the sum of all the knowledge we have in humanity is massive. And the number of professions, there are thousands of professions, and there's millions of tasks we do in these professions. Getting computers to do all of those tasks across all of the domains, science and management and social, you know, service and, you know, all of these things, it's a massive, massive task. So I don't look at, you know, singularity as the issue, to be honest with you. I look at, you know, what will happen if we do not use computers to solve some of the big problems we have. You know, if you want to solve cancer, if you want to solve the environment, if you want to solve education, no more effective education, I look at it as essential. You know, these kinds of AI machines are essential to solve the big problems. So I think we need to keep doing that. And I really think it's very, very far from all of these dystopian scenarios.
Yeah, several other people have said that to me. I was talking to Michio Kaku the other day, and we were talking about the concern over autonomous weapons. You know, there have been talks about having some kind of a UN ban on them and so forth. And he said, honestly, that's so far off in the future, it's not worth talking about right now. Would you agree with them?
I think many of the scenarios that people are worried about today are really coming from fiction.
Yeah.
And from all of the movies and books that we see and hear about. So, I mean, it's great imagination, but in terms of real technology and science that's going on, these scenarios are actually very far out. Also, you know, there definitely are technologies that are already at human-level intelligence. You know, Jeopardy was an example of where a machine beat a human-level champion. So I think there's going to be slices of, you know, tasks and activities that we do where we want machines to be better than humans, because humans are not super at everything, you know?
Yeah.
You can't read 1,000 articles per day, for example, right? So we want to build computers that are super in some areas, but I think this notion of general intelligence where a computer can do everything better than a human is really fantasy at this point.
So singularity, I'm assuming then, is not really a goal at IBM.
Absolutely not. It's the goal is really to address the big challenges that humanity is facing, right? Like I said, the healthcare challenges, mm-hmm. the education, you know, environmental challenges. Those are the practical applications. I think we are already seeing progress and we are applying in very concrete scenarios that people are seeing benefits from. So that's where we'll keep pushing it.
Okay. Now, is there the possibility that we could stumble on to singularity?
Well, look, you know, scientific discovery is unpredictable by its nature, okay? So, you know, we have in the last 5 years, I think, discovered a lot of great algorithms that can do things with data that we never thought was possible. So, you know, I look forward to actually finding algorithms that can help us understand human knowledge better. So, you know, there are many things that... you know, that I believe cognitive computers should be helping us do. And I hope we can discover those things soon.
When I first got my iPhone, I started, you know, as everyone did, we would sit there and mess around with Siri and just throw crazy questions out at her.
Yeah.
Do you ever ask Watson, you know, what is the meaning of life?
Or Oh, yeah.
If you ask Watson, what would he say?
We have gotten 42, I guess. But no, I'm just kidding. but look, you know, we do test Watson on some pretty, you know, difficult scenarios. And, you know, in many cases, you know, there is data to find the answers to the crazy questions we ask. And in many cases, there isn't enough data to find the answer. So, you know, we have to realize that there are limits to these computers and because they are as good as the data.
Not enough data in the world, huh?
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. Where do you see Watson going from here in the next, say, 10 years?
Yeah. You know, my vision is that every professional on the planet, and we're talking about a couple of billion people, will have a cognitive assistant like Watson to help with their day-to-day task, right? So, you talk about Siri as a personal assistant for you, but imagine that you also had a professional assistant who was helping you do your work every day. And that requires a very different kind of a computing system because it needs to understand what do you do for work? What is the knowledge behind it? You know, how do you get trained for it? You know, what is considered good, meaning, you know, a professional level, you know, result or outcome for the work that you do. And imagine the thousands of tasks, thousands of professions like that in the world. So I would like Watson to be available to every professional and help them do their job every day.
Does it ever bother you when people compare Watson to Siri?
It does. Is it because they're not even in the same league. They're not even in the same league. Yes. Right.
Well, that's very exciting. Yeah. Guru Bhanavar, thank you so much for joining me to talk about artificial intelligence.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
We're going to take a quick break. And then in the next half, I'll talk with Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots, who fears that artificial intelligence along the lines that Guru Bhanavar just talked about is nothing short of a recipe for global economic collapse. And then I'll talk with the co-founder of Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly, who says AI won't replace humans, but instead it'll work as a partner for humans that frees us up to focus on the things we want to do and the things that humans do best. When we come back in just a moment. Hey folks, do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews. to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. My next guest says we're fooling ourselves if we think the kind of cognitive technology being pioneered by Guru Banavar is going to create as many jobs as it replaces. Martin Ford has more than 25 years of experience in computer design and software development, and his New York Times bestseller, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, won the 2015 Financial Times McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award. He's alarmed that artificial intelligence could threaten jobs far beyond the manufacturing sector and lead to an economic disaster.
Machines, computers, in a limited way, are now beginning to think. You know, they're taking on cognitive capability. It's not just about mechanical processes or muscle power. It's now about brain power. And this is something that's really entirely new, and it's much broader than it has been in the past. You can point to examples like computers that did computation in the past, but now we've got machines that are truly beginning to think in a broader sense. And, you know, that's really quite disruptive. And I think that where it leads to is that we're going to get to the point where nearly all of the routine, repetitive, predictable work in the economy is going to be automated. And that's going to have just an enormous impact on the number of jobs and the type of jobs that are available.
What kind of time horizon are we looking at for robotics to become relatively pervasive? In other words, how long do we have to look for a new job?
Well, I tend to think in terms of a 10 to 20 year time frame, in terms of this really becoming unambiguous and obvious and potentially disruptive. But really, that's a guess. In many ways, I think it's a fairly conservative guess. I think that I have certainly talked to people that are involved in these technologies, and particularly not so much robotics, but machine learning, you know, the advances we're seeing in artificial intelligence, where these algorithms are getting better and better at learning. If you talk to some of the people involved in those technologies, they're thinking it could be more in the 5 to 10 year time horizon. So it's entirely possible that all of this could happen long before we expect it, and certainly long before we are in any way prepared for it.
Are we looking at large-scale unemployment, societal unrest, maybe even riots?
That's a possibility at some point. There's a range of possible outcomes here. Certainly mass unemployment is one possibility, especially if this unfolds at a rate that is maybe faster than what we're ready for, and if we're totally unprepared, you can't rule out that possibility. A less extreme possibility is that we just see a continuation of what we see now, which is that average people have got stagnant wages. Average people are often underemployed, where they do have a job, but they don't get enough hours, or the job that they can find doesn't really utilize their skills and so forth. So we could see that worsen. That would be a sort of a tamer version of this. However it works out, it's not going to be good in terms of the impact on society and in terms of the political response that you're going to see. So I do think that we're going to see people more and more disenfranchised, people more and more angry, and that can lead to all kinds of bad things.
I talked to Guru Banavar, the head of the Watson Project at IBM. He says we don't have to worry too much about the singularity. Does that concern you at all?
I would tend to agree that we don't need to worry about it anytime soon. I mean, what I found is that if you talk to people like Guru that have a lot of expertise in artificial intelligence or really work in this area, they're not too worried about that. The people that have spoken out, warning us that super intelligence is going to be an existential threat, the machines are going to take over. They've been people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk. Very smart people, very prominent individuals, but not doing actual research in artificial intelligence, right?
Yeah.
So I think if you talk to the people actually working in AI, they tend to be a bit more humble. Having said that, you know, I don't think it's a silly concern. It's not ridiculous. It shouldn't be not something we should laugh at. Someday it may be an incredibly important issue. I mean, obviously, if you talk to people working in artificial intelligence, they do believe that eventually we will build a machine that can think like a person. And if that happens, that's going to be incredibly disruptive. I mean, as Stephen Hawking said, that will be the biggest thing in human history. And I think that's not wrong. At that point, there is a whole can of worms there that opens up. So it's not, Elon Musk, for example, has donated a lot of money to set up think tanks that are thinking about this issue. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, it's something that we should be giving some thought to. I don't think that it's a major issue for society that we should be dumping all kinds of resources, you know, as a society worrying about that. But certainly if Elon wants to set up think tanks to engage in it, I think that that's a positive thing, because someday, it might be 30, 50, 100 years from now, maybe that is going to be an existential issue.
I ran all of this by another tech expert named Kevin Kelly. He's the founding executive editor of Wired magazine. He still holds the title of senior maverick at Wired and writes and lectures about the future of technology. In his newest bestseller, called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future, he talks extensively about the potential upside of AI over the next 30 years. In fact, he says he can't wait for artificial intelligence. Well, I read the book by Martin Ford, Rise of the Robots, which painted a pretty grim view of robotics and AI as half the world is going to be out of a job. You say, however, that we're going to welcome robot replacement. How will it come about that we embrace robotics and AI?
So what robots and AIs are really good at is optimizing things for efficiency and productivity. It's to take known things and to just do them to perfection. Any aspect or any task we can possibly imagine, whether it's physical or mental, where efficiency or productivity is of importance, that goes to the bots. And that's like, you know, counting money as a cashier. And this is a job no human should be doing. We'll be embarrassed in 100 years from now that humans actually had to sit and count money. That seems like ludicrously insane. And it relieves us because we didn't like those to begin with. A lot of the jobs that politicians are fighting over are really jobs that nobody is getting up in the morning saying, I can't wait to do this. Those are the jobs and tasks that go to the robots. And they're liberating because we don't have to do them.
So then what jobs does that leave for us humans?
What we're left with are the kinds of things that either we're doing for the very first time or initially in the very, very beginning. We don't know how it is. We don't know what's happening. These are jobs that are by definition, or tasks that are by definition, inherently inefficient. Exploring is inefficient. Science is inefficient. Innovation is incredibly inefficient because you're going from one failure to another. You're trying out stuff. There's dead end. Trial and error, the error part, it's about failure. The failure is by definition inefficient. So there's a huge inefficiency in the kinds of things that we like most. And it's not just intellectual stuff. Like human relationships are by definition inefficient. There's all that repetition. It's not at all in any way optimized for efficiency. It's the other way around. And so experiences, human experiences, are not efficient. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to gravitate to. They don't require college degrees per se. They can be something as simple as someone holding our hand while we're sick. Mm-hmm. That's something humans are really good at, something we really crave, something we value, and something we're going to pay money for. And so we could say, in a certain sense, just to conclude, that our job in the future will be to invent jobs to give to the machines.
You say that you can pretty much predict the business plans of the next 10,000 startups. It's going to be take X and add AI. So talk about, I guess, some examples of everyday items that are ripe for cognification in the next 30 years.
In this first industrial revolution, you could suddenly take anything that was manual and you could electrify it. You could make it into, you could take a hand manual water pump and make it into electric pump. And that was a source of both innovation, wealth, and convenience for people. And this formula of take something in your life, something that's maybe unsuspecting, unconventional, not obvious, and then you add AI and then you have something new. So let's take something like, you know, something as old-fashioned and boring as taxi cabs. We'll add AI and you get Uber. Just repeat that. Again and again, take something that doesn't seem obvious. You know, toys. Add some AI, and you get these dolls that don't stop talking or whatever, and that that kids will fall in love with. I mean, they yeah. will love these like they love a dog or a pet, and
yeah,
they will
that
be loved
was interesting
back.
To me. Yeah, how you said that toys will be like pets.
Because it turns out, actually, that programming with emotion is not difficult. We think, well, emotion is like intelligence is easy and adding emotions to these things is hard. No, no, it's the other way around. And emotion is actually very easy to program in. And these things will have programmed emotions, including things that we will read as love, as affection. And so, take something else. Take fashion. Add AI to fashion. Add AI to food. Add AI to furniture.
It's safe to say that you're bullish on artificial intelligence.
Sure. It's endless. And this is a moment when all the easy things are available. It's like being back at the beginning of the internet when you could get any domain name you wanted, or you could take anything and bring it online. And the picture you want to have in your mind is of us inventing hundreds of different kinds of thinking, or hundreds of different species of minds, if you want, all of them different. None of them like humans, and therefore it's very difficult to say, well, are they smarter than humans? Well, your calculator today is already smarter than you are.
True.
It's a genius in arithmetic. Your navigation system is a genius in spatial navigation, and much smarter than you are. And of course, Google is miles and miles smarter than you are in recall. And so that feat is simply inhuman. And that's what AIs will be as we populate all the different ways of thinking, is that they're going to think differently. And thinking different is the engine of wealth and innovation and all kinds of goodness, this new economy.
I notice in your book and also in our conversation that you use the term cognitive intelligence rather than artificial intelligence. I'm guessing that that's not an accident.
Yeah, and by the word cognification, I mean to make things smarter. And I'm trying to avoid the term artificial intelligence, because when we hear that,
it's
we have
a loaded term.
A lot of preconceptions. We imagine a human intelligence. And yeah. What I want to stress is that a lot of this artificial smartness is not human-like. That's one of the main reasons why we want it. It's because we want it in our car, driving our cars, because it's not going to be distracted like a human mind is. It's going to really focus on driving much better than a human.
You use the example of the chess match between Garry Kasparov, a former guest of the show, and IBM's Deep Blue, and what happened after that as an appropriate example of how humans and AI will get along down the road.
So Kasparov was the world's best chess champion, and he was pitted against the best AI at the time, which was something called Deep Blue by IBM. In a famous match, Kasparov lost, and it was, for many people, it was a real shock. Kasparov complained after losing. He was shocked too. After losing, he complained, saying, you know, it was kind of really unfair, because Deep Blue had access to this database of every single chess move that had ever been played. And Kasparov said, well, if I had had access to that same database, I would have beat Deep Blue. And so he decided to create a chess league where you could play any way you wanted, including playing with that database, or you could just be an AI playing as an AI, or you could be a human. And in the last 3 or 4 years, the best chess player on the planet is not an AI, and it's not a human. It's a team of AI and humans. And that points us to the kind of direction that we're going, because the best medical diagnostician on the planet is not the later, it's not Watson, the IBM that currently is this big supercomputer, which is doing medical diagnosis. It's not Watson. It's not a doctor. It's the centaur of Watson plus a doctor, because both of them are thinking differently. The thing about the AIs is that they don't think like a human. And so when you have the team, you actually have a much broader, wider kind of intelligence that even the smartest genius, a human, can't really compete against, because it's a broader kind of intelligence. And so I wouldn't say it's complementary. I think it's just that it's broader. And so we're really going to be paid, I think, in the future by how well we work as a centaur, how well we work with these things rather than against them. And there will be problems, difficult problems in business and in science that are just really simply probably not able to be solved by human thinking alone, that it will require this broader kind of intelligence.
In the next 30 or so years, is it pretty safe to say that AI will be pervasive and even an essential part of our daily lives?
This kind of power, this artificial intelligence, this artificial smartness will become, or kind of already is becoming, a commodity, a utility, like electricity. You know, in 30 years from now, people will look back at this time, 2016, they'll say, oh my gosh, I wish I could have been alive and young and full of ideas and energy and knowing what I know now, because everything was right there before them. This would have been the time, 2016, to start these things, because we're at the ground level of this second industrial revolution. It's like being present at the moment when electricity and motors were first coming. And you could think, what could I have done? Imagine what I could have done there. And so here we are.
Well, Kevin Kelly, thanks so much for taking time to talk to me about artificial intelligence.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for asking great questions.
Later this month, I'll have an entire episode with Kevin Kelly in which we talk about his new book, and the many ways life will change in the next 30 years, covering AI, virtual reality, and societal and economic trends such as consumers' shift from ownership to access, and a world in which we're in a continual state of gradual advances and constant upgrades to both our technology and ourselves. But in the meantime, we're going to stay on the topic of artificial intelligence on the next podcast. In part two on AI, I'll talk with Professor Nick Bostrom of Oxford University, who authored the book Superintelligence, which has become standard reading for anyone interested in artificial intelligence. And I'll also talk with Seth Baum, director of the Global Catastrophic Risk Institute. They're two of the prominent thought leaders in the discussion of artificial intelligence, and they're warning that scientists need to approach AI with caution, because they say once it's unleashed, it may evolve faster than we think and in ways we never imagined. Then, I'll talk with the creators of AMC's drama series Humans about how their show envisions what life would be like in a world with conscious artificial intelligence, and the moral dilemmas both for the AI creators and their created, not the least of which is this: if we create technology that achieves human consciousness, is it then entitled to the same rights as human beings? Coming up in the next episode. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then you can order Martin Ford's book, Rise of the Robots, and Kevin Kelly's book, The Inevitable, on Amazon. I'll include links in the show notes and on our website, and you can also download the audio versions of their books for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners from audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Visit Martin Ford's blog at econfuture.wordpress.com. Kevin Kelly's website is kk.org, not to be confused with kkk.org. And if you're interested in IBM's cognitive solutions, including Watson, visit ibm.com/cognitive. On Twitter, follow Kevin Kelly @Kevin2Kelly, Martin Ford @MFordFuture, and Guruduth Banavar's Twitter handle is @Banavar, Banavar. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.